Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be.
Welcome to our latest episode of Book Reporter Talks To. Our guest today is John Sargent. We're going to be talking about his memoir, Turning Pages, The Adventures and Misadventures of a Publisher. I've known John for years, and he's someone I really respect. He spent four decades on the front lines of publishing, often taking stances that were bold and decisive for the good of authors, readers, and what he refers to, this is my favorite line, the publishing ecosystem. He says that a lot. While he shares behind the scenes in publishing business in this book, there's always a lot of humor, as I think that John can be self-deprecating in all the best of ways. Kristen Hannah had this to say about Turning Pages. John Sargent is everything I expect from this extraordinary, honorable, and talented man. I will always be grateful that a big part of my career took place at St. Martin's Press under his leadership. I could always count on John to do the right thing, even when it was hard and unpopular. His wide-ranging life story, unexpected and interesting from the very start, is insightful, thoughtful, and hard to put down. And I agree with that. I stood in the pool reading this book and went page to page. I laughed, I even cried, and I enjoyed every moment of the ride. And yes, Kristen, I agree with you. I felt the same way. So welcome, John. It's so good to see you again.
Great to see you. How are you?
I'm really good. All right. It's like, you know, doing this home studio thing. It's a whole different game. Like my house has lights, you know, what can I say? Yeah. It's a Today show from my house, you know? So let's start with what made you decide to write a memoir?
So I didn't start out to write a memoir. I started out to write the, 40 or 50 best stories from my work life. And the plan was to have them be individual stories. And the editors that I worked with consistently said, you need to put more of yourself in there. And I was like, I don't want to. And then they were like, well, we need to hear about, you know, how you grew up. And I said, God, that's the stuff I always skip over when I'm reading this type of book. And I said, I don't want to do that. And they kept pushing. And finally, I just, you know, said, well, they know better than I do. So I, and they were consistent on it too. So I put in a bunch of stuff about my family, which I was always reticent about. It makes me uncomfortable, right? But it is a remarkable family. And so I ended up putting that in. And then, you know, I put in the growing up out West stuff. And once you're in it, you say, okay, well, we got to do it. Here we go, right? So I put a bunch of that, but I tried to keep it really short and crisp. There's a prologue that's kind of long and wandering about the history of the family. But in the book itself, it's told in very short stories that are, I hope, illustrative of a period of my life. But I tried to make it not a slog, you know, okay, then John goes off to high school, you know, oh my God, you know, I don't have to do that.
You've got some pictures to fill in some of the missing pieces.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh yeah, I didn't get that one, but there's a picture.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Up front, you mentioned that there's a sort of tyranny and only telling the good stories. And I love this line. Was it tough to decide what you're going to write, what you're going to put down on the page?
Yeah, the tyranny of good stories thing is that you're what I wanted to do was just tell the good stories and strip out all the sort of the boring stuff in the middle that you get if you're trying to do the straight sort of narrative arc of a human life. There's a lot of stuff in the middle that's not overly exciting. And I wanted to get rid of all that and just tell the really good stuff. And of course, the problem is that doesn't necessarily tell about your life. It is not necessarily sequential. And it sort of is much more of a wander as opposed to a straight line thing. So, but I pretty, you know, I stuck to that. The stories are good. There's a bunch of stories that didn't make it because they weren't good enough stories, even though it was important stuff. You know, a good example is the lawsuit with Google was, you know, Jesus, 8 years of my life. And it was a huge thing. And Richard Sarnoff and I were the lead negotiators beginning to end for the publishing industry and dealing with the authors and with Google. And this is when cloud computing was starting and Google wanted to give away everything for free. And it was a huge part of my life. But in the end, there wasn't a good story in it. It was just endless slogging negotiations. So, you know, it made, whereas the Amazon thing was a good story. So I got to tell, you know, I got to tell one of the big things in my career, but the other one, I, you know, it sort of make little reference to it in one story, but it's just a little reference.
Yeah. It was really funny. There was somewhere where you do giving depositions and they said, don't swear. I was laughing because years ago I was deposed by Barnes & Noble over something and it was the day. Okay. First of all, I'm there. And it's just a little aside and I'm there and it's this really long meeting. Yeah. And I'm looking at them and I said, I gave you the answer 3 hours ago. And I said, you're just not listening to me because they kept trying to come at all these different angles. Yeah. And I said, look, how much of each are you making an hour right now? I said, I'm making nothing. So listen to what I'm saying. And then I swore and they turned around and they said, you do realize that the family, the Riggio brothers are going to be listening to this. And I said, do you want me to say it again? I don't want to be here anymore. So I got back to the office and the power went out. That was the day the power went out in New York. And I said, and now I've got to slog my way back to New Jersey because we were doing that stupid thing 10 times. So when I read that line, I was like, oh my gosh, that's what they meant.
Yeah. No, so the first of all, the Riggio brothers would not mind at all that you swore. So to hell with the lawyers in that case, because the Riggio, that's all fine with them. But yeah, these were all video recorded, right? And so they could all be played in court. And so they really didn't want you coming off like a longshoreman. And so for the most part, I managed not to swear. I swear a lot. I managed not to swear, but yeah. There was a moment or two where, you know,
it just slipped out.
It was a pleasure too, when it did slip out. I have to tell you.
Why are we still doing this? You know, that was me. Why are we still doing this? You know? Yeah. So what was the first piece you tackled? Was it the first piece we see in the book? It's the first piece is where we are. It's a prologue. The prologue is the first thing you wrote.
No, the prologue was the last thing I wrote. That was to get the family stuff in a way that didn't interfere with the stories. Mm-hmm. So the prologue's like one big story of the history of my family, right, is the prologue. But you don't have to read that, right? You go right to the stories. And a lot of people don't read the prologue. So not interested in the family, don't read the prologue was what I was thinking of it. The first one I wrote is not part of the book, which was the last story about surfing with my son. And I had set out, you know, I can't even recall now the precise moment and what drove me to say, I'm actually now going to do these as a book. Because there was my great grandfather's book and there was these things I had been writing. And in with my son, I tried to write, I intentionally tried to write in a single story. I tried to show the magic of a father-son relationship and the arc of time. And, you know, the son follows the father and what was magical about it, because it's magical. It really is. If, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of dads who their sons don't get along really well and all that, but boy, if you get along well with your son, there are these moments that are just fantastic. And I try to pick one and tell a story, and it's not, there's no, you know, you could read the story and not know that that's what I was trying to do, right? It's, it's totally a story, but in the story, I wanted the story to capture that, so that when you put it down, you would say, you know, God, fantastic father and son, you know? So that's the one that I remember having all the way completed first, because I did it for a different reason.
You know, and it's interesting. When I was reading that story, I was thinking about not only your relationship, but you were thinking back, like you, his age and where you go. And you're thinking back on, oh, wow, he's got all this great stuff ahead of him. And it is great stuff ahead of him. No matter what happens, it's great stuff along the way. And the other thing is your spirit of adventure, because you basically follow a guy with a truck out to this location. Like, where are we supposed to go? And there's an enormous amount of trust in that in Mexico. There's an enormous amount of.
Yeah. And it's an adventure that you're sharing. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, the magical thing is the age differential drops away. Right? The energy of youth is just so fantastic. And you feel young again. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're with your son doing something adventurous, the type of stuff you'd love to do when you were his age, and he's loving it too. The years that separate you just go away. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic.
And you're not thinking about, gee, if I get up doing this at my age, I could break a bone. You're not thinking that.
It's like overwhelmingly fantastic.
Yeah. Everything else sheds away. Yeah. It's like the best ski run you do. And it outweighs every other thing you've done all week. Yeah. All week. It's like, yeah. That's it.
Or you can ski for like 5 years and then have one run, mm-hmm. that's just like, whoa. Yeah. If you have that moment and you can have it with your son, mm-hmm. it's pretty special.
Yeah, absolutely. And, the best. You know,
equally with your daughter, but it's different. Mm-hmm. You can't get in your daughter's head the same way you can get in your son's head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my husband, when he does things with the boys, it's totally different. It's totally different than hanging out with them. It's different.
Yeah, it's different. It just is. Mm-hmm. It's spectacular, but it's different.
So there are four parts of the book. We've got Going West, Early Years, the long section about Macmillan, and final chapter. And when you were writing the piece, did you decide the order at the beginning, or how did it come to be sections? Was it to just break it up for the reader?
Yeah. So the sections came, I had these stories block of stories, go to one to the other. And the original intent was to have it be like a bathroom book, you read it in any order, little 5 minute chunks of a book that you could read. But the editors were consistent that that you had to help the reader more. Mm-hmm. The reader doesn't want to be, mm-hmm. dislocated time and time and time again and not have a framework and a reference place. So the sections are a way to try to give the reader an idea of what's coming, mm-hmm. So that they can put the stories together in their mind of what point in life this is happening. And what's in this chunk of the book, and that gives it more of a sense of flow was the attempt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also the little words at the beginning of each section is sort of tell us what's going to happen in this one, and they're just little buzzwords. It's just like this is this, and then you put the story together later on.
Yeah,
love that. I absolutely love it. So your family has these deep roots in publishing long before you enter the business on your mom's side. And there are three generations of Doubleday, if I remember correctly. Yeah. I did not grow up in publishing. I never worked at a publisher. So I came out of magazines. So I don't know any of these big histories. Bought what and went where. So what was it like growing up in a publishing family?
So there are three generations before mine. So I was a fourth generation. It wasn't like that. My mom, who was a Doubleday, sort of left all that behind. Mm-hmm. The fancy cocktail parties, the authors, the A-list dinners, all that stuff. And she just said, I'm not interested in that anymore. And she moved out to Wyoming. And that's when the first time we went out there was I was 7. We moved there permanently when I was 8. And so I grew up in, rural Wyoming. There were no authors around. There were no publishers around. There was no bookstore in town. There were, it was rural Wyoming. There were no first run movies.
Wow.
And there's no television because television was all broadcast and we lived too far from a television tower. Mm. So no TV, no first run movies, no bookstore. It wasn't what you would call a publishing environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. We were out in Colorado one time. In fact, I have a picture on my wall up there, and there's this road and it just goes like this, and there's nothing on this road. Yeah. I stopped and I said to my husband, let me take a picture. I said, see this road, this was made for Amazon. I said, that little United Parcel UPS truck just going down the road delivering to these people, because there is not a store in a really large swath of where we're headed right now. And I frame that and have it up on my wall to sort of remember, this is America. This is what
that's what the book club business, which is now very small, but was huge early in my career. There were more books going out through book clubs than there were going out through the trade bookstores.
Right.
And it was because there weren't bookstores in America, because, the cities could support them. But if you live in a town of 50,000 people or less, there wasn't enough business to keep a bookstore going. back in those days. And so essentially America got their books through Book of the Month Club or Literary Guild or all of that were huge. I mean, the print runs, you know, were 300,000-400,000 copies of a main selection going out to people. And they're still, and of course, Amazon's now taking care of that, as you said.
Amazon and then Book of the Month Club has come back. They've come back and seems like they're going for a younger audience. They're trying to, it's different. It's different. And they're curating differently than they did before. Yeah. I mean, before it was, we're just going to take the book. And there were also different book clubs, if I remember. I remember at the beginning of my career, there were Bertelsmann book parties for the clubs. And I think it was like in September. And there was this huge party that they would throw. And we'd be like, and it's like, yeah, the clubs, this is how big it is. And you weren't even thinking about that business at that point. It's
I think literary Doubleday book clubs had the Literary Guild and Doubleday Book Club. And then they had, you know, 16 smaller clubs, the military book club, the history book club. It was a big business.
Yeah, it was big business. Totally different. Totally different. So I know that you spent part of your youth out west and then your first job was traveling. And you were at the academic publisher, which I loved because I could just picture you like, you know, handling the books out of the back of your car. And I love that Motel 6 was the big motel. Like that was like a high end.
I was living large, man. When I saw Motel 6 in town, I was like, woohoo. Yeah.
So I feel like many people in publishing are entrenched in this New York culture. It's even people who live someplace else. You move here and you become, the big goal is to become a New Yorker and to think like a New Yorker and everything like that. And even if they came from other places or visit other places, it's like they go back to like do a quick visit or they'll go back to travel someplace, but they're in and out. And I think that New York supersedes them thinking about the rest of the country. And reading your background, I feel like what you brought to your job was a broader view of America. And I feel like that infused your marketing of books and everything that you did as a publisher, because you were thinking of a larger scope, not just here.
Yeah. And particularly in the author base, right? There's books for everybody and they're about the same. And, you know, toward the end of my time at Macmillan, I remember lots of emotional intensity around, you know, who we should be publishing. You know, we should publish this person and we shouldn't publish that person. And this person did this and therefore we shouldn't do his book. And one of the interesting things, I talked to an editor once who was you know, absolutely adamant that we should not be publishing a book by this particular author. And they wanted to not work on the book. So I said, well, okay, we'll find someone else to work on a book. And I went home that night and I thought about it. And I went back the next day and I said, you know what? I'm going to rescind that. You got to work on the book. I said, because we have 300 people in our warehouse in Virginia. And they're in rural Virginia. And they every day pick, pack, and ship books that go against all their sense of values, go against their values they have from church, from family. They're doing that, and they know it's not their call. Mm-hmm. If we publish it, you pick it, pack it, and ship it. And I'm not going to treat the people in New York different from the people in Virginia. No. So guess what? It's not your call. Yeah. You may not want to work on this particular book, but you got to work on it. Yeah. If you work here, you don't have to work here. But if you want to work here, you got to work on this book. There was, for me, a sensibility of the broader America, right? Mm-hmm. That America is made up of, well, if you look at it now, politically, it's a 50-50 split, right? Mm-hmm. And those other people, they're nothing, you know, they're bright, fun, charismatic, intelligent. Yeah, they're great people. They just look at the world differently. Mm-hmm. And you know, this sort of condemning of them as, you know, evil or stupid or something is in my mind, not right, you know? So I was always open to publishing people that we got in trouble for publishing, or people in the company we didn't want to publish, or we got scorched in the press for publishing. I thought everybody should tell their story, right? Mm-hmm. We should let people tell their story, and we should let the audience find the books. And if the book offends you, don't buy it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? If the person offends you, don't buy it.
I remember at the height of the Christian publishing market with Left Behind and Purpose Driven Life, I went to that convention. And it was very interesting to be in a place where everybody was not exactly like me. Everybody was, I have to tell you, at dinner, I always used to get in trouble because I would either eat and then we'd have to do the prayer and I forgot, or I wouldn't start eating and there would be no prayer. So I was always in trouble. I always did the wrong thing. Yeah. But by the same token, for going and seeing how large that market was and seeing what was going on, it gave me a much bigger scope. Going to ALA and seeing librarians from across the country, being able to go talk about somebody where their budget was this big. Like it's not, you're going to go buy every book and it's not on auto buy. I found that really interesting just to watch.
Yeah, they've got to look, booksellers and librarians, school librarians, public librarians, and all range of booksellers have to buy for the audience in their community, whatever that size and scope of that community is. And if you're a small town library, you know, a Carnegie Library in the middle of America, you're buying the books that your community wants to read if you're doing your job well. Because you, as you say, you got a limited budget. And if you're a great librarian, you're also trying to put other books on the shelf that they might read to get a different point of view. Because that's what a library is for. That's what books are for, right? Yeah. You don't want to just read what reinforces what's in your head already. You need to read what's not in your head. That's how you learn. And that, and you know, have, let everybody lay their arguments out there. They should all have the right to do that. We should all read the arguments from all sides in order to make our decisions. And that's the beauty of a library. And good librarians give the full, you know, full gamut.
Yeah, full range of what's going on. Let's discuss this topic. Let's, you know, put it out there. So you met Jeff Bezos very, very early in his career in 1995. And you continue to meet with him and his team throughout the years. And it was really funny. He says, I'm this humble guy. I'm drumming up with my station wagon. You know, like, this is what we're driving across the country, blah, blah, blah. So his pricing of books, he got them down to their wholesale prices. Those were his loss leaders. And he said, I don't care. I remember he said, I can do this as long as I want. Like, I can do this in infinity. Of all the products he could loss lead on, why were you surprised he chose books? Or is it like,
no, Jeff's extremely rational guy, an extremely good decision maker, very, very intelligent, and incredibly ambitious. And he studied it and he determined that books were the ideal consumer good to sell on the internet because, you know, a bookstore can't possibly hold the hundreds of thousands of new books that are published every year. There are no bookstore big enough to do that. And the internet has limited, unlimited shelf space. So they can. And so, you know, he always had the plan to make Amazon huge with all these goods, but we never knew that, right? We always thought he was just going to be a bookstore. And so, you know, I remember my frame of mind was like, he can't do this. You know, he's spending all his money on technology. He's building warehouses all over the place, new corporate headquarters in Seattle. He's buying a book for $10 and he's selling it for $9.95. That can't work. But what he knew, of course, was that if you bought that book, you'd want to buy not only books, but eventually you'd want to buy everything from them.
Yeah.
And so the, he had funding and he was all about growing. He wasn't about trying to make profits in the early years. That never entered the formula at all. It was growth. And so discount until you get a ton of business. And if you need to keep discounting, keep discounting. And, you know, I was dumb as a post comparatively. You know, I'm sitting there talking to him and I just can't figure it out. I'm like, how can that be? How can he keep doing this? You know,
and he says forever.
Turns out he could keep doing it.
But you know what's interesting too, by what you read. Okay, if you buy a book on knitting, then he knows he could sell you knitting products. Yeah. If you find that you buy a book on gardening, I can sell you. So you can also look at the products. We think in terms of fiction so much, and nonfiction is such a huge part of the market. So to be able to distill the kinds of books people are buying to figure out what products you're going to put where. Really incredible. And the fact that like I can order a size 2 knitting needle and it comes the next day and then do a 3, a 4, and a 5 with a metal tip and they get there. And it's, if I went to a store, I'll be honest with you, they would not have what I'm going to look for in the breadth that I'm looking for.
I remember when they made one of their big leaps, I was out in Seattle, and the woman in charge of publisher relations at the time was from Microsoft. She was very smart. And I asked her, she was talking about warehouse expansion stuff, and I asked her, how's it going to work? So you get, you know, they were going from 8 warehouses to 52 or something, you know. And I was like, how the hell are you going to do that? How are you going to decide what goes in what warehouse? And she laid it out for me. I remember she spent a half hour, you know, walking me through the algorithms and how they're going to work and blah, 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 blah. I remember I got to the end, I was like, oh my God, my head hurts. I'm a reasonably bright human, and God damn, that is complicated. Oh, and this was when it was still small, right? Yes. The scale just exploded, but they were always remarkable that way. Amazon was always just way ahead. And you have it exactly right, is think about books. There's nothing as good as books to determine what other things might people want, because books are so slivered, right? You can get the book not only on traveling in Alaska, not only in Alaska national parks, but you can get a book on Alaska state parks within 3 miles of Anchorage, right? Mm-hmm. You can get, and so if they know what books you're reading, they know what else to sell you. And mm-hmm. I would not be surprised. I never talked to him about it, but I would not be surprised if that didn't go into Jeff's calculation when he decided on books from the get-go, right? Was the information he would be getting about people would mm-hmm. be so bad. And that's why they started those retail stores. The retail stores was all about, it was either going to scale and be huge, or he was going to close it down. I was always convinced of that. And they ended up closing it down. But it was about understanding how people shop.
Mm-hmm.
They understood how people shop online, but that's different from how they shop in the stores. And it was all trying to understand shopping behavior mm-hmm. in stores.
Well, it's like he had a whole shelf of the 5-star reviews. These have all gotten all 5-star reviews.
Using all his advantages, using all his advantages. And actually, I always thought initially that when you went into those stores, it was about getting Prime membership. Because mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember, mm-hmm. when you went and scanned the book, it would say, you know, this costs you, you know, $17.92. If you were a Prime member, it would cost you $14.22. You could save 3 cents by being a Prime member. And it was a way to put the Amazon name up on every street in America mm-hmm. and essentially have an engine to drive people into Prime. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the way these guys thought about everything. You know, it was 2, 3, 4 layers of thought process on everything.
And they also had the products. They had all the different kinds of devices for reading. They had every Fire Stick, everything you'd want to buy. So if you were there and you wanted to touch the device before you bought it, you could go do it and you could preview what it was going to do. So very, very interesting. But they also took care of a lot of the details. And I really love the story of the Amazon dinner where you got the special meal. Everyone else got served at the table, and they did bring you exactly what you wanted. And what was your favorite meal, John? Because I love this.
I was a huge McDonald's fan, and I loved the quarter pounder with fries. And I, you know, people laugh at me because I go to Europe, and I'd only go to McDonald's, and because you knew what you were getting, and you knew what it was going to taste like, and I just loved it. And so, you know, they had this big swell dinner and they served everybody the swell food, and the guy lifts up the silver dome, you know, to serve the meal. And for me, it's, you know, they had a quarter pounder still in its box from McDonald's and the fries sitting up against the thing. It was done with presentation, you know, the fries were sitting up like this in front. I'm looking at the waiter going, the waiter's laughing, right? And the people at my table all start howling. Yeah, it was a fun moment. It was a fun moment.
But it was a definite John moment. I remember the year you were honored at UJA and you go, no black tie. No black tie.
Yeah,
no
I'm, black hey, tie. Hey, I'm personally responsible for getting black tie out of the UJA dinner. They never had another black tie after it. I told them they were twisting my arm and twisting my arm. I finally said, look, I'll do this for you, but I'm not doing black tie. And furthermore, I'm not doing a tie. If we're doing it with me, we're doing it informal. And And, you know, they had red and white checkered tablecloths in this big fancy place. And I remember I had this thing I wanted to do in my speech, and I had everybody get miniature bottles of Bud Light, which was my favorite beer. And there was a moment before where apparently Jane Friedman said, we can't have Bud Light, we got to have Heineken. And Barbara Marcus had to back her off, you know, say, no, John's not going to accept Heineken. He really is. Trust me on this. He wants Bud Light, it's going to be Bud Light. So,
and I think that Jane was the one that had the reaction to no tuxes too. What? No tuxes?
Yeah, I don't know about that, but I heard that there was a move put forward down. You know, we can't have this, you know, Bud Light.
Well, you know, for years I was told that you weren't big on business lunches and you preferred meetings. Like you wanted to sit down and like, just come to my office. Just come to my office. We don't have to go out to lunch. And I really love that because when I started in this business, I try to meet with people and they say, I can have lunch in 3 months. And I'd go, okay. And then they'd say, but I can have coffee or a drink sooner. And I was coming from a different business. I was completely perplexed because in the magazine business, you just went and calls on people. It was, you know, no big deal. And I just sat there and I was like, am I some kind of a heretic? Because I said, can we just meet? Like, do we not? Yeah. No food. I'll bring the food. Okay. If we have to have food, I'll bring food. And I just.
And I had a thing at work. I never took employees to lunch.
Ah, okay.
And the reason was I never wanted to show favoritism. Mm-hmm. And we're all human, right? And so if you go to lunch and you really have a good time and you really connect with someone, you want to go to lunch with them again. Mm-hmm. And if you go to lunch with someone and guess what? You're just two different people and the chemistry isn't that good. Both competent in your jobs and all that, but you know, and then you wouldn't naturally call them again.
Right.
And then you'd have employees say, oh, John went to lunch with this person, this person, this person, didn't go to lunch with me. And what I realized early in my career, is you go up the ladder, the intensity with which the employees look at you multiplies horrifically as you get closer and closer to the top. And when you get the CEO job, it's like being under a microscope all day, every day. Everybody watches everything you do. Mm-hmm. So I would have people on the rare occasion, you know, I would once in a blue moon, I'd go to lunch with an employee because I had to for a particular reason. And people would know about it when I got back to work. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd see us leaving the building together at lunchtime and you know, oh, John's going out to lunch. And so I thought, I'm not going to do it because, I don't want people to feel I'm one of John's people or I'm not one of John's people or John spends more time with this person than that person. So I was really pretty rigorous on not doing that. And then I stopped going to the all the pub parties and the cocktail parties because I had to get home for my dinner with my kids.
Right.
That was my deal. When I was in town, I was 6:30 every night. I was home for dinner with the kids. Mm-hmm. And so I just stopped going to the parties. And a remarkable thing, no matter who you are in publishing, if you say no consistently for like a couple of years, people stop asking you. They really do.
You don't have to do it anymore. A lot of times people say to me, do you want to come in? I'm working in New Jersey now. They said, do you want to come into the city? And I said, select occasions. Yeah. And a lot of times, not during the day. I said, because I didn't have lunch. And I have to say, the remote, like meet the author online, love it. Absolutely love it. I can watch from 12 to 12:30 and keep working. Because lunch, at a big publisher lunch, meant you left the office at 12. Lunch was 12 to 2:30, 12:30 to 2:30. They got back at 3. It's 3 hours. Long time.
Yeah, particularly in the early days. And there was, you know, one or two martinis before, a bottle of wine each. And, you know, I remember when I worked at Doubleday, you know, a lot of the senior management come back from lunch. You didn't want to go see them after lunch. You might get a bad decision, you know.
We knew that the magazine, too. We asked before 12. Before 12, you asked all 12, big questions. Right?
Because they were all getting that, you know, going out and having a lot of drinks at lunch.
Mm-hmm. It was a totally different time. It was, I don't know. Now people like getting them to go to the office is a big deal. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, you're going to the office again. You know, you were well known for taking on Amazon, Google, and anyone who you felt that hurt authors in the publishing ecosystem that I thought about earlier. And as we think about the past, you were often the lone publisher that was out saying, we have to do this, the lone ranger. And did this surprise you, or as the time went on, did you say, like, I've got the balance of my convictions. I'm just going to, I really do believe in this. It's not like I'm making it up, and I'm going to go do it anyway.
Well, the big ones were Amazon. I'll never know if it was pure chance or not. Mm-hmm. It was because, you know, when we went to the agency model with Apple and all that stuff, I felt I needed to talk to them straight up. I wasn't going to call them on the phone. I wasn't going to, you know, write them an email. So when we signed the contract with Apple, I got on a plane mm-hmm. and I flew out to see them. Mm-hmm. And I was the first guy, and as far as I know, the only guy who did that. And so, you know, they unloaded on me. Or at that point, we were the smallest of the big six publishers. Mm-hmm. And maybe they had decided already they were going to pick us because of that. Or I had a very good relationship with these guys, and they knew that I was not, I was prone to being very pragmatic and not prone to, you know, getting all wild and, you know, sending out press releases and stuff like that. So they may have chose for that reason. I'll never know why, but, and then the Google one, I was asked by the AAP to do it. Mm-hmm. So I did it. The library one, nobody else was doing it. And yeah. it was just, you know, it was clear as a bell to me what the problem was. And so we tackled it. So yeah, I was out, you know, it got to be a little bit much by the end. I was looking around like, yeah.
Hello? Again.
How many other guys want to, and everybody's saying, you know, oh, you're doing the right stuff. It's great. Okay.
Feel free to show up and get yelled at too. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. You know, join me. You could join me here.
Yeah. And I, you know, it's funny because authors will sit there and say, oh, my ebook sales are up. And I'm like, how many are library? And I said, it's going to change your bottom line. It's going to change. And they're looking. And I'm like, no. I know a lot about this from John Sargent. Trust me. I know what I'm talking about. You know?
And you know, it's pure math. You can just do the math and see what's mm-hmm. going to happen. But, you know, it's hard. The authors very much agreed mm-hmm. with us, Authors Guild and all that. But, you know, so many of the authors love libraries. Mm-hmm. I always love, you know,
yes,
I
me too.
Devoted to libraries. I'm a huge fan of libraries. And they didn't want any part of taking on libraries. So, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people just were under tremendous pressure not to do it. And, mm-hmm. you know, we lost some authors because of it and took a big financial whack because of it. But at the same time, I think it did probably bring the issue to the fore, as it were, right? Yes. So there was some purpose to it. But it's, those were difficult. There were a bunch of times that, you know, sort of felt like I was taking all the arrows for a bit. But it was never planned that way. I never wanted it to be that way. It fate or whatever.
But sort of, I love Sally's line, which we won't quote here. Let everybody get to read that in the book. But I love Sally's line of like, you know.
Yeah.
Enough already. So, you know, now I watch Amazon coming after the sports market in a huge way and every other market and what's done. I mean, you really watch what's going on right now with the writer strike, streaming, what's going on with the network fight with Spectrum, with ESPN or ABC. You watch the whole thing happening and you realize this thing that was like even broadcast that was like three networks at the beginning and then went out. It's so construed right now, so crazy. Figuring out AI and what's going on with all the strike could go on forever because the two things they're trying to negotiate are streaming and AI, and there is no model. There is no model for making this go forward.
Which was the problem with you know, when the digital transformation came to books, there was no model, right? So mm-hmm. it's a lot of work to create the model from scratch. It's a lot of work. You know, with these big industries now, they're huge industries, getting all the constituents to agree on what the model should be is difficult. And you are always going to end up in court. Mm-hmm. You know, when AI and copyright get together, Congress isn't going to legislate that. That's going to happen when some publisher or the AAP or somebody decides to sue somebody who's using it. You know, you get Nora Roberts' book. You feed every Nora Roberts book she ever wrote into AI, and then you say, give me a Western that's a Nora Roberts book. Mm-hmm. And AI is going to pump out a really good book that's Nora Roberts as a Western.
Mm-hmm.
And Nora's not going to get a penny for that. And that's not right. because it's Nora that's creating that book, and Nora works hard as hell. And
she yes. Yes.
And she works hard, and she's been working hard for decades and decades. They can't take that. That's hers, right? And someone's going to have to, you know, get into it. It's going to be, that'll be the next one. That's coming after the digital transformation. That's going to be the next one. It'll be interesting to watch. But somebody's going to have to do it.
Yeah, she, and I remember at conferences, she'd still write her 2,000 words a day before she came downstairs. And she wanted to write another series because there wasn't enough to just be doing this. I've got to be doing something else as well. Fabulously committed to work. But you're right. It could be bloated into something else so quickly right now.
Because there's so much of it, right? And it's consistent.
Yes.
You know, she writes a type of book. And she always writes that type of book. And therefore, you can take all those together and you could do it pretty quickly.
Well, you know, my personal pet peeve is the COPPA law. This is my pet peeve because when we first started, we had kids and teen sites on AOL. And we had chat rooms and message boards. We had to take those down because we weren't allowed to market to children. Okay.
Yeah.
Flash forward to now, everybody's got a cell phone at age 9 and they're being marketed to all day long and they're making videos on TikTok. And I want to go down to the FTC, which I did do the first time and said, so wait a second, they can do things when they're 13. It's like putting them on Route 78 on roller skates. You're not teaching them how to use the internet, which is what we're doing. And now it's a free for all. And everybody seems to think this is perfectly okay. And I want to go back down and say, huh? Where'd we go?
I don't know. We got far fast. It's hard there. You know, the next generations will solve this.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in a different time. You grew up in a different time.
Yeah.
And I look at that stuff and I say, that's theirs to solve. It's going to be their world and they've got to solve it in a way that satisfies them.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? See what happens.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I don't have particularly a lot to give to that. Right. Cause I came from a different place.
Yeah. Yeah. But you do talk about specific books and brought up a lot of memories with Chicka Chicka Boom Boom. And I read that and I was like, oh my gosh, can I still recite the lines? Because I did that with the kids so many nights. And the hearing the beat of the book. And, you know, I hadn't thought about things that you brought up, like the saturated color and how to reproduce that. And all these things about the printing process. And then I was surprised when you said something like BNN wasn't an early adopter of the book. And it was such an interesting thing because I know I bought all my kids' books at that BNN on Fifth Avenue at lunchtime. Yeah. You know?
It's an interesting book. And it's amazing how I taught at Pace University at their publishing program this year. And I got asked, you know, what book you're most proud of or whatever. And that's one of them. And I looked at this crowd and they're all like, I don't know, 23 to 26. And there's probably 40 of them in the room. And I thought for a minute, I thought, wait a minute. The math works. The math works. That book was published when these kids were 1, 2, and 3 years old.
Right.
So I said, how many of you remember a book called Chicka Chicka Boom Boom? And they all put their hands up.
Yeah.
100%.
Right, right.
Like, whoa, you know, how cool is that? that was amazing. That was an amazing experience, that book.
Yeah. And it is those early things of when you read the book, that's what one of the things that I'm getting at is you've got those little touchstone stories like that. And then you've got stories about the people you met along the way, like Fergie the Duchess and spending your time at Buckingham Palace and Michael Jackson and that very funny story with Britney Spears, Monica Lewinsky and Bill and Hillary and Barack and your fabulous moment with Barack of what you say. And I could go on and on. And I felt like reading those. It was a great reminiscence of just what this whole breadth of this career, who you got to meet because of where you sat and what you did.
For me, it's like a love letter to the business I was in for all those years, right? It's just so fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to write a book, and the people who write books and the people who have life stories that people want to read about, it's just fantastic. You work with these people all the time, and it was trying to give a little bit of the sense of awe and wonder of what that's like, you know, to be in a job that just constantly puts you in front of, think of the fiction writers and you know, their minds. And you know, some of them completely unassuming, shy, retiring, you know, small physical stature. And you look at him, you think, oh my God, you know, what that brain created. I remember the, I was at a party. It was in the summer. It was at my house. And Tom Harris was there. And Tom comes out and he's got a beer in each hand and or drink in each hand and get this big smile on his face. And he, you know, he's a great guy. And out he comes and I look at him and I think, Jesus, he looks like a completely normal Joe. But out of that brain came Silence of the Lambs.
Right.
Whoa.
Yes.
Whoa. What's that? Because when that came out, that was truly an original work. There was nothing like that had ever been published before. Mm-hmm. And you just look and you think, what a brain that man has. Mm-hmm. And how different it is from my brain and every other brain in the room.
Yeah, how's he's going to
make that up whole cloth, you know?
Yeah.
So, it is, it's a remarkable business to be in. And I wanted to share that without it being sort of overwhelming and without being sort of a list of here's the people I met or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so what I tried to do is find little stories. And one of the things I remember reading my great-grandfather's book was he wasn't a great writer and it's not a great book in any way, but you'd run into these little things. He'd be talking about like staff meetings and how you have to run a staff meeting and why we moved from, he was the first business that moved out of New York City into the suburbs and mm-hmm. why we moved to Garden City, blah, 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 you're reading this. And then like for one little paragraph, it says, it's so difficult getting this done when Teddy keeps calling from the White House about his book. Oh shit, Teddy Roosevelt's calling from the White House every day, you know? And so having people whose name you recognize mm-hmm. has a certain value because you recognize their name. Mm-hmm. If it's Joe Smith, Joe Smith was calling me every day. That's not that interesting. Yeah. But Teddy Roosevelt calling from the White House, pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, oh, that's who's on the line. That's who's on the line. Yeah. You know, the work people you work with mattered, no matter, you know, who they were to you. You can just tell people mattered. And your piece on Matthew Scheer, who was the publisher of St. Martin's, was really wonderful. And while it really shows so much about who Matthew was, I remember the last time I saw him, it was at St. Martin's Press 2019 Thriller Fest party. And I was 13. And I walked out and I turned around and he was sitting on a chair talking to Jen Enderlin. And they were like this in conversation as they would want to do, right? And it remains that snapshot of the last time I saw Matt. And Matt was walking that party and talking to everybody. And later on, I remember whenever I used to meet parties, he says we're going to get a lot more business. And I remember Keith Cahill used to say to me, how many drinks did he have before he told you that, Carol? Like, he was always very funny. He's always very funny about that. But I felt like I always regretted missing his funeral. It was the same day my son started school. What did you love about Matt? Because it so comes through, not that you didn't love other employees, but I think that the embodiment of what you feel about employees was so much in that story about Matt.
Yeah, it was, Matt was, he had an ego and he had a vision, but he cared deeply about others and he didn't need the credit, mm-hmm. So he's forever giving credit to, you'd say, wow, that was a great idea. And he'd say, actually, it wasn't mine. It was my assistant's.
Mm-hmm.
He would do that like regularly. Mm-hmm. And so he embodied the sort of, the group spirit,
mm-hmm.
sense of we're all working together here. And I don't need to have the credit. What's important is that the book sells.
Mm-hmm.
And he had such joy in his work. He loved what he did. And he would show it. You could see it all the time. He'd have that big booming laugh and he'd say, let's go do this. And he was just damn fun to be with.
Yeah.
And he had some stuff he struggled with. He's admirable the way he struggled.
Mm-hmm.
Admirable. He was admirable the way he tackled problems. And we had times where we had some issues between me and him. And I had to talk to him, straight. And he was remarkable in that, he listened. Matthew always listened.
Yeah.
And he always gave you credit for your point of view, even if it was something he knew better than you did. He gave you credit for it. So you're a remarkable man. And just, you know, fun to be with. You look forward to being with him. And everybody looked forward to being with Matthew. Everybody. You go back to this, your random house. You go back in time to anybody who ever worked with Matthew Shearer.
Right.
And they all had the same thing with, boy, he was a lot of fun.
Right.
And that says a lot about what I think builds a good culture at work.
Yeah.
It's having fun. You know, it's about building a place and a culture where when they come, people want to come to work because they have fun when they go to work. Because people do a better job when they have fun.
Yeah, and he had great ideas and he wanted to hear what people. I can't believe it's been gone 10 years. I just sat there the other day and go, wow, it's been 10 years. It was a huge loss in the business just because of who he was bringing up with him. And John Andrew and I have had many conversations about Matt. And it was just like, he was just this one kind of a kind guy.
Yeah,
and you can't make a Matt. You can't make a Matt. He made himself, you know?
Yeah, that big gap tooth grin he had, you know? Oh, it was fantastic.
And the laugh. And I'm like, oh, So the book about life at Macmillan has to include something about the iconic Flatiron Building, which was home to you till 2019. What do you love about that place?
Well, it's just a fantastic building. You know, if you look at it from the outside, it's just sensational. Particularly, it sits in the middle of New York. And all these ugly, big-ass square buildings all around it and a skyline. And then this thing is, if you look at it carefully, the construction is fantastic, right? Because the point gets sharper and sharper as it goes up. And you have to actually look carefully to see it. Mm-hmm. But the windows on the top floor and the point are, you know, this wide. And the windows on the lower floors and the point are this wide. Mm-hmm. It actually narrows this way. And it's a weird shape. It's not a pure triangle. It's an off-center triangle. And it just looks, if you look at it head on, it looks extraordinarily thin, thinner than it is. And it's all done with this sort of really careful process to give it these different views from different angles. It's a piece of art, basically, sitting there. And the inside, of course, is a complete disaster. But the outside is spectacular.
Yeah, you know, I really love it because it looked like a ship to me. It looked like a ship sailing down the middle of the avenue with those. And I could just picture putting a sail up on top and it was just going to come like sail down the street.
My office was up on the floor they designed for the head of the Fuller Brush Company, it was going to be the fancy floor. So it had, I don't know, 14-foot ceilings, right? And it was the highest. There was a little tiny floor above it with little short ceilings, but this was the main thing. And my office had a little balcony out the front, little tiny balcony. And it's the only floor that has it. And you can't see it from the street. You don't realize there's a balcony there in the street. But you could go out and stand in the balcony in the front. And everybody who went out there would do this from the Leo DiCaprio movie. You know, they'd all go like this, like standing in the front of the Titanic. So it's a ship, right? It immediately made you feel like you were standing like Leo on the bow of the Titanic. Everybody would do it. When they came out to be on the balcony.
Yeah, you're the captain of the ship. And everybody, if you want to see what it looks like, John's author photo is on the balcony outside his ship, outside the office. Yeah. So you got to take a look at the author picture to fairly understand this. And I would say that's so John when I saw the picture. You know, it had so many quirks. I mean, the elevators were so slow at the beginning that we used to arrive 15 minutes early for meetings. And we said we had some of our best meetings in the lobby without the people that we were supposed to see. It was like just everybody else you would go see. Yeah. And then I think it was about the time where we were in an older building at the time. They were putting in sprinkler systems. And if I remember correctly, they were saying, like, you'd have to move out. They put the sprinklers in and then you could come back. But you could pay the rent to them and to the other space. But then you could come back and the sprinklers would be there. And it was like, wait, this makes no sense.
The old boilers would go out when it got cold. They would never tell us this. I figured it out. And Sonny the Super is fantastic. the boilers, when it got really cold, they'd have to turn the thing off because it was wearing out. So, you know, you'd be sitting in your office. It'd be a nice toasty, I don't know, 68 degrees. And suddenly at 1 o'clock, the temperatures start to drop. And by 1:45, it'd be like 40 degrees in your office. What the hell? And then suddenly it started getting warmer again. It's because I had to turn the boiler off to give it a rest.
It's like, we did not know those things were happening. We did not know. So then you move downtown, you go to these very cool offices, the best offices. 9 months later, the pandemic happens and like everybody goes home and da, da, da. And the beautiful office with a long lease and no people with them. And I felt like the pandemic time was time we had to go like this to make decisions. I mean, you didn't have days to make decisions. It's you're going to do this. Try not to make anything long range because you just didn't know it was. We were lucky our lease was ending. And if they'd come down and had me sign, I would have been it for 3 more years. So luckily they were so slow, it didn't happen. What was the most challenging those days? Like when we all didn't know what was going on.
That's easy. It's employees. Employees. The level of emotional pain in the employee base.
Yeah.
Was incredible because it's New York City, right? And a very large part of our population was young, right? Entry level, second level. Mm-hmm. So these are people between the age of, call it 22 and 35. They don't make a lot of money. They're living in small apartments in New York. And in New York City, there's sirens going all night, every night. And there's morgue trucks, freezer trucks in front of the hospitals full of dead bodies. And these people have grandparents who are, alone and dying. And the emotional weight of the pandemic on the people was extraordinary. And then they're just sitting on Zoom all day. Some of them are going out of their apartment. They're that scared. And so you had to do everything to try to figure out how to help them.
Yeah.
And that became the job. So very heavy emotional weight, lots of emotional weight.
Yeah.
How to help, I don't know, at that point, globally, a couple thousand people. Because people all over the world had the same problem, right? Our offices in Germany had the problem. South Africa was, oh my God, our office in South Africa, they were having, food shortages and, their whole economy stopped. They didn't process any ships coming into their harbor. I mean, they had problems that were just, and it'd be a steady flow of this and trying to make the best decisions for all those employees and all those countries emotionally overwhelmed, really. Job.
And Australia, go home. This one, go here. This, go there. What are you doing here? How are you handling it? It became a 24-hour job too. Because at the same time, you're also wondering about the business. Like, what's going to happen? Are we going to be able to get books out? What about warehouses? What about, if you are thinking about all these things. And it was interesting because I wrote one of the CEOs, somebody was on one morning talking to agents and I slipped into the call and they were like really super concerned. And I wrote this person, I said, it was April or May of 2020. I said, look, books are going to have a golden age for at least the next year or two. And here's why. There's going to be no sports. There's going to be no theater. We're not going anyplace. And the only thing you're going to be able to do is get these books. And this person completely doubted me. And they were like, oh, you're so optimistic. And I was like, no. We're going to have a really good 2 years. But where we go after that is going to be the challenge.
Yeah.
Because what we're going to do is everybody's going to be home. And my theory was the first year you go see your family after everything happens, then you go to your favorite place, then you go to the place of your dreams, and then everyone goes to Europe. And this summer, I had so many friends in Portugal that really, I thought we were going to be in each other's pictures, what was going on. But I really felt that we were going to have a couple of really, of years that was going to struggle to produce, but good years.
You could tell by April or May. Mm-hmm. It's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And I remember when we discovered it was a few weeks in, and what we looked and what we discovered about the supply, all the supply chain stuff, remember supply chain. What we discovered is if Barnes and Noble was running out of books, the same books, the sales would increase in Target. Mm-hmm. If Amazon was running out, the book would increase in the independent booksellers who were putting, packaging them in their store and handing them to people on the street. And what you realize is people go find the books.
Mm-hmm.
If one person, they wanted a book, one person didn't have it, they'll keep shopping until they find the book. And we saw that. I thought, you know, this is going to be fine. This is going to be fine, because even with the supply chain as bad as it is, the demand for these books are going to be there. And you can feel it.
And they could also hear about them
by June. By June, the figures were just fantastic.
I agree. I sat there and I said, this is going to be a golden age. This is going to be a really good moment. You can learn about them online. You're going to increase going to library digitally. You're going to be taking all the digital content out that requires no shipping. You're going to get into audio. You're going to get into an ebook that you might not have read before. You're going to try different things because you can, or you have to.
I wasn't as smart as you. I wasn't, I didn't have that whole thing worked out because there were so many difficulties. Getting the books printed was, you know, whoa. And at that point we were struggling with the growing ebooks, because remember what happened to music, right? If the digital form grows too fast, you put all the retailers out of business, right? There's a record store. There were no record stores in America, but that went from one on every corner to none in like a year. And you could see that coming. And so it was difficult to be sure. I was never sure. But as soon as we saw how hard people were chasing individual titles, get the sense that, you know, we're going to be okay. And then by September, I was pretty sure we were going to have a monster 2 or 3 years, because we had a great list coming up and we had all these movie tie-ins coming up. And it was like, whoa, we're going to have a huge, you know, it's going to be huge the next couple of years. And it was huge. I wasn't there to see it, but it was huge.
It was huge. It really, really got out there, you know? So, you know, got the whole spring, so own Macmillan. They cut salaries in the early days of the pandemic. They were worried. And, you know, you say, look, it was restored, because you saw where we were going. You saw everything was, you know, headed in a much better direction. Were the financials usually the biggest battle that with them was finances, money, making sure?
We didn't have, over the years, there weren't a lot of battles. But they were great owners, you know. They let us. You know, I would come and I'd say, okay, we got this situation. We got these people we've just hired and we've started these companies. Now we're going to grow. So I'm going to we're going to have less profit for the next 5 years. And instead, we're going to grow like hell. And they say, okay, go. And we do that. And, you know, yahoo, we grow like hell and we weren't as profitable and they were fine. Right. I think what happened is the pressures of the pandemic were great on them psychologically. The other Germans, and the culturally Germans tend to be a lot more pessimistic than Americans. Remember the Germans had their wealth redistributed twice in a lifetime, right? Mm-hmm. And that means they have a much more vivid sense of what can go wrong financially. They have a visceral sense of it. So I think just it was, and they didn't have anywhere near as big a bounce as we had, because they didn't have COVID as bad as we had. And so they didn't get as big a bounce. So they weren't overly difficult as owners. They're pretty good owners over the years.
Yeah, you expanded a lot over the years. The things that you did, the bringing everybody into the building, remember that everybody was all over town and putting everybody together. And, you know, those were big moments of what to do. And those new offices downtown were stunning. And there were stunning ways to be able to entertain authors. I mean, it was like,
It was built for that, right? It was built to grow. But, you know, everybody says, you know, publishing today, the problems, it's always this way. It's been for 40 years. It's been, you know, here comes the sky is falling because of this. And then the sky's falling because of that. But it's a hugely resilient business. And the young people in the business are fantastic.
Fantastic, and you know what, too?
Right? Everybody's saying, you know, these employees are the headaches. But at the end of the day, they're smart. They're hugely enthusiastic about books and about the business. They work hard, you know, they're, I don't have this sort of, you know, publishing as we know it is gone. Publishing as we knew it has always gone. It was always something else. Every 10 or 15, 20 years, it became something else, and it'll continue to become something else. So
yeah, and if you've been around long enough, you see that's what it's going to be. You see, right. It's like, okay,
good books will still sell, bad books won't, you know.
Look, I remember when I was at Condé Nast, and as I was leaving, Epicurious was starting, and it was the internet, and no one knew what it was. And when I went to do this, they were like, well, why didn't you take the job at House and Garden? And why didn't you take this other job? And I was like, because I think this is the future. Like, I think this is going to be a good thing. And, you know, it's also, there's just something.
Yeah, clearly, I should have been calling you much more often. Because you had that shit figured out.
But here's what's really funny is Steve Newhouse at the Newhouse family, he was around my age, a little bit, maybe younger, I don't remember, something like that. My dad worked with him on one of the newspapers. And he said, we should take the newspapers online. He was doing all the stuff, and he got stopped by the family because people at the top said, this is not profitable. Cy said, print will always live. And I exchanged notes with Steve a couple of years ago. And I said, if they'd only listened to you, you would not be where you are right now, because he saw the bigger thing.
But his dad was right too, right?
Yeah.
The book always did live. And I think the book always will live.
Yes, the book always will live. Yes.
I think it'll always be in different formats, but I think it's always going to be paper. There's always going to be paper books.
Book is one thing. The magazine of way you could distribute information. I remember being there and saying, okay, you do the story here and you do the sidebar online and you match the two of them together so that there's a total experience going on. You don't have to be 3 months before online. You don't have to go to the printer.
Which house of your friends have you gone to that has a nice shelf of old magazines on it? Nobody, right?
I have the old Rolling Stones in the attic and the old Mademoiselle's. And my husband's like, we could make a lot more room if we got rid of this stuff.
You make some money on that stuff too.
I know. I said, yeah, maybe we'll go out on eBay, you know, blah, blah, blah. So then we get to the moment where you were let go, which I think the reaction when the industry was shock. I mean, that was the word across the industry. And we heard conjecture of what it might have been, blah, blah, blah. But no matter what it was the end of an era. And it was the end of 2020. I didn't realize your last day was actually my birthday, December 7th. I mean, like, come on. So it's like, you know, 2020 comes along. You didn't even get to see everybody you want to see because everybody wasn't around at that point.
There was nobody around.
Did you ever feel you got the closure you wanted? Did you ever feel you got the closure on this thing? Because that's tough. When I left the magazine, it's tough to say closure worked, you know?
I don't know. Closure is an interesting word, right? It was very strange to go in after all those years. I ran Macmillan 24 years. Go in and go into your office and pack all your stuff up and take your box and walk out. And it had leaked that I was doing that. So there were, I don't know, 20 people who came to work. Mm-hmm. So they went out and got a cake or something, you know. But it was pretty weird. Pretty weird. And, you know, then I'm gone. But it was fine too. Mm-hmm. You know, it was fine because it allowed for a fresh start faster probably than mm-hmm. if I was cycling through, you know, 4 months of retirement parties and people taking me to lunches and bull, mm-hmm. you know, and I didn't know what I was going to do next. I was just like, I'm going to go live like an animal on earth, you know, get up in the morning and do what's fun today and see where it takes me. So I don't know. I don't struggle from a lack of closure. It closed,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was a quick thing. I mean, they were talking about, oh, we could call this early retirement and we could adjust the time. I'm like, oh, I never lied to the Macmillan employees yet. I'm not going to start now. I said, you know, I'm going to say you fired me. Oh, wait a minute. We can't say that. Well, guess what? Guess what? Yes, we can. I'm not going to spend the next, you know, 3 weeks wandering around telling everybody, oh, I've decided that I want to pursue other interests. which employee is going to believe that I walked out on them in the middle of the pandemic?
Right.
Who
right.
can believe that? They're gonna look at me and they're gonna say, you're lying to our face.
Yeah, it's true.
I said, I'm not gonna do it. I'm, you know, so it became quick and hard.
Mm-hmm.
If people knew why, it would have made them much more anxious.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I was not willing to do that. right? I was trying so hard to take their anxiety level down. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to say, you know, here's why it happened and here's what I did, because that would just cause them to be anxious, more anxious. So in a way, I couldn't say anything to anybody.
Yeah.
The company wasn't going to say anything. So it just sort of floated out, no reason given. And, you know, if I had said it, it would have been really, really difficult for people.
Yeah.
Much more difficult than it was. So I decided just to go.
Because it's either going to happen or it's not going to happen. I'm leaving and it's either going to do it or it's not going to happen. Whatever it was, it's going to play itself through. So let's go to the title. Was this always the title? I'm trying to get it. You have like nice glossy. You have nice glossy. See what happens when you do glossy in the light?
Yeah. It was an endless, as titles always are, it was an endless sort of thing. But at that thing on the front there, mm-hmm. the sculpture my daughter made for me out of one of my favorite books by Larry McMurtry called Leaving Cheyenne. She took the paper back and she painstakingly, every page there is varnished. So that sits on my dresser as a sculpture. And the guys at Arcade were great. They let me have a hand in designing the jacket. And I said I wanted to put that on the jacket. And turning pages was, I was trying to get something that worked that was about book, you know, had some book publishing thing to it, had something about the books in it that was descriptive of what was in the book. And I ended with that, but it was a long slog to get there. Yeah, and a lot of people chipping in and throwing out earlier titles I had and saying, you know, no, John, that's a bad idea. so finally ended with this one. And
it's so hard, but it is. But you do turn the pages reading it, everybody. I mean, I had so much fun reading it. And it's not just because I knew you. It was just like you learned a lot at the same time about the business, like the chicka chicka boom boom. Okay, like printing that color was really, really going to be tough. Who knew?
Yeah, you know? It was. My attempt was to try to walk the line of making it fun and interesting for anybody who liked books. So call it the layman of publishing. And at the same time, make it fun and interesting for the people who spent their life in publishing.
Mm-hmm.
So try to not make it technical and ununderstandable for anybody. But at the same time, don't try to teach the world, you know, here's publishing 101 mm-hmm. for the people in publishing to go, oh my God. So, you know, very conscious effort to try to peg it right in the middle.
And treat people kindly too. There were other books that came out. There was one that came out earlier this year that was like The Skewer. And you're just sitting there like, well, I know that would never be you, but it was just, they're like, whoa, 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 whoa on every page.
I tried to get through it without, I'm not going to offend anybody. Mm-hmm. And I probably didn't succeed. There's probably a couple people in there who would be pissed. But they're dead, most of them. So but you know, they all have spouses or kids and stuff like that. So I tried to be conscious. I didn't want to be mean in any way, but I also didn't want to be not factual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So some of the biggest characters, I mean, there are big characters in publishing, said shit that, you know, you just go, whoa, my God, they said that. And I didn't want to sugarcoat them and lose the characters they were.
Mm-hmm.
So I was honest about what they said and how they said it and what it made me realize. And I tried to think, okay, would they be pissed if they read it? And I said, they might be. But when they were, after they were pissed, they'd sit back and say, well, at least he told it straight.
Or he included me.
Right? Yeah, but, you know, I wanted, Dick Snyder, famous people in publishing, famous tough guy, nasty boss, you know. And you didn't want to paint him as a sweetheart guy to make Dick feel good, right? Mm-hmm. You had to say who Dick was. Mm-hmm. But, Dick, you know, I imagine Dick reading that story and going, well, not very nice of Sergeant to include this, that, and the other, but he had it about right. you know, which is what I thought Dick would probably end up saying. You know, not very nice of him to put it in there, but he had it right. So there's a few places where I'm trying to describe these big characters,
yeah,
you know, and how remarkable they were. You know, just amazing,
yeah,
creative talents and driven guys and great publishers and just huge personalities. Huge. Mm-hmm. Which is lacking in today's publishing. There's fewer of those huge personalities. So I wanted to give a sense of what those guys were like.
Mm-hmm. And for
I respect those guys. A few of those guys were not nice guys.
Right.
They weren't nice guys. Well, I respected them. I respected the results they got. And I respected what they were doing and how they were doing it. I wouldn't have done it that way. And sometimes they were cruel.
Mm-hmm.
But they were remarkable in their own ways.
Yeah. It was a different time though, too. It was a different time. I mean, look at the people in publishing. Oh my gosh.
Magazines
and everything. It was like, whoa.
I disagree with you. I think it is a different time, but the personalities will be there at the end of the day. Because yeah. Publishing rewards big personalities. The publishing, they'll be there at the end of the day. And you look at the guys today in industry that we look to, you know, you look like a guy like Elon Musk, you know, that's a big character. I mean, that guy is amazing. Now, I don't agree with everything he does and says, and I disagree with a lot of what he does and says, but you can't say he's not an interesting human.
I can't say that at all.
Interesting guy, right? And you look at that and you say, the world needs that. And then, you know, you have Jeff Bezos, he's an interesting man. You know, you need these sort of guys to drive stuff forward, guys who aren't worrying about stepping on toes and doing that. They need to be, and there'll be a bunch of them. Publishing will reward that, and they'll be in publishing. There'll be rewards to being those type of guys in publishing.
Well, there's a book coming out about Sam Bankman-Fried, and I have to say that kid totally. I cannot believe how much he got away with. I just cannot believe how much he made up. And I said, I've just got to read this book because yeah, I also right? was amazed that he ran his business on QuickBooks, a multi-billion-dollar company using QuickBooks. I didn't know it had enough zeros on it. You know,
I don't know that, you know, who that guy is or what he's like or anything, but he's a fascinating guy. Look at that brand he built. I'm gonna never be seen photographed or on TV without my hair being a complete rat's nest on top of me. And that's not a normal thing, you know? I mean, he's an interesting guy. Elon Musk, I'm going to sleep on a dog in a dog bed next to my desk so I don't have to go home and waste all the time. He's sleeping in a dog bed. Who would do that? I mean, so it's you know, it's interesting. And
if you have like really crazy kids, maybe it's really okay because we'll see where it goes from there, you know.
Oh yeah. And you know, the fascinating publishing could be fantastic in the next, I think, 10 years, because you look at the second tier in publishing and the third tier and the fourth tier from the top, and they're all really interesting people and they're almost all female.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in the next 10 or 15 years, the top job is going to go all female, I think, or almost all, not all, but, you know, of the top 10 publishers, there'll be seven of them run by women,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's going to be really interesting. It's going to change a lot of stuff in publishing. Mm-hmm. And all the diversity that's working at the bottom levels, it takes time, but those people are all coming up too. You can't come into the business and be the editor in chief the next day. So there's going to be a time of that growing up, and there it's going to be different. Mm-hmm. 10 years from now, it's going to be different. It's going to be really interesting.
Yeah. It's always interesting to watch.
It's going to be fun to watch. Yeah.
So you recorded the audio version. So you're in the studio and you're recording the book and you're reading. Tough, easy. Did you want to change words as you were going? Or just like,
it's fascinating. The biggest thing is you realize is when you write a book to be read by eyes, you don't write a book to be read aloud. Different if you're doing, I assume, I've never done it, but poetry, screenplay, different. When I wrote kids' books, it was different. You do syllable by syllable to try to make the sentences sound a certain way. Yeah. Adult books, you just write them and you don't worry about what it's going to sound like. So I wrote all kinds of tongue twisters, as it turns out. It's just not easy to read the words. A long, complex sentence, you know, semicolon, couple commas, it ends up being hard to read. And you start four words with an S, you know, whoa, Christ, here we go. It was interesting. And you're not allowed to, the single most interesting thing I learned about myself, and it's apparently common to all authors, is when you're recording, you're in that sound booth for a long time, and your stomach makes noise. Yes. And the microphones are so sensitive, they hear, even when you can't hear or feel, your stomach growling, it's down there making noise. So like she'd say, we got stomach noise, you have to read that paragraph over. I'm going, my stomach didn't make any noise, but apparently it did. Apparently this is hugely common, happens with almost every instance. Which, you know, that's something to learn about your body. It's interesting.
Yeah.
But it was fun. It was fun. I had a good time doing it. They sent me, you know, four narrators. And to be honest with you, my wife listened to all four and said, no chance. These four people cannot read your words because the way you talk and the way you are, it has to be you. And I said, okay, well, that's good advice. So I said, you know, well, I'd read it. And so they nicely said, fine.
Now, there was no other reader. I was saying this. I said, there was no other reader. It had to be you. It had to be you doing it.
Because I talk a certain way, and the language in the book is, I tried to very much, because it's telling stories, I tried to make it like I speak.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to make it like you're sitting with me and I'm telling you a story, is mm-hmm. what I tried to make it like. So in informal language with, you know, sort of, up and down points with, you know, short pointed things when you want to tell the sort of key bit of the story. I tried to make it feel like I was telling you a story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I use language because of where I grew up. My language is, I use weird words. I say theater, you know, crick, not creek. And I use that way I speak and the way I write. So
yeah,
it was pretty weird to hear a guy with a, you know, a normal sort of New York accent reading that stuff.
You just your wife going, no, this is not going to work. No.
So what? She was the first one to make the call. Others agreed with her afterwards, but she was the first one to make the call.
So what are you doing now? What are you working on? What are you?
So I'm doing this book and doing things like this for the book. I took on the role of as chairman of the Ocean Conservancy, which is, way back now, 14, 15 years ago, I did the carbon thing at Macmillan because I came to the realization that that was really important. And so we tried to, I think we reduced our carbon footprint by 60% or something. It was a massive decade long effort to do it. That's always, it's been a long time concern of mine. And so they asked me to be chairman. I agreed. So I'm going to be chairman of the board of that. I consult people. I don't ever want to have to answer the phone. So I have a bunch of consulting clients, mostly individuals. And the deal is hamburger lunch, White Castle or better is my rate card. And then I'll be on the end of the phone, ready to advise you on any issue you want advice on. And so I have a bunch of people who take me up on that. And then, you know, so I have not-for-profit stuff I'm doing. And then my mom died right after I got canned. My mother died. And she left everything to the University of Wyoming. And it's out in Wyoming. It's highly complicated stuff. So, you know, I'm sort of trying to run a cattle ranch and the benefit of the University of Wyoming and artist and writers residency for the University of Wyoming and a property development thing. And I'm, you know, doing that stuff.
It's a lot. And if you have like, you know, those things that happen, my mom passed away last summer and it's all these things happen. My husband's mom passed away. And he's like, you have all these things that you need to deal with, and all these, like, what are we going to do with all these stuff? Like all these things that, and I know you were writing at her desk, if I remember correctly, you were writing, did you write at the desk before it was her desk? Am I remembering that right?
Yeah. No, I wrote in my daughter's room. There's a small desk that my grandfather had one of his favorite authors is also, he personally liked the guy a lot, and his Somerset mom, and, you know, Jewish and living in France. So he built a cottage behind his house, and he brought Somerset over from Mr. Mom, as he was called always, Mr. Mom. He brought Mr. Mom over from Europe and ensconced him in the house, in this little cottage behind his house. And that's where he lived through the war. And he wrote Razor's Edge on the desk.
Wow.
And it's a very tiny desk. And it was, my aunt had it, and she had it in her apartment. Then when my aunt was like, I got to get rid of this desk. And she, you know, she always liked my daughter. And so I said, you know, I'll take the desk if you don't want it. And she said, fine. And so I have Somerset, you know, the desk that Somerset mom wrote Razor's Edge is my daughter's homework desk. It's a little tiny thing. I wrote a bunch of the book on that desk, which is fun to think about, right?
Yeah. And if it snows, you can go skiing now. You can just go out to Wyoming. There's a little bit of freedom there too, you know? It's like,
yeah, there's a lot of freedom. I am a believer that you should try to enjoy life to a great extent. And I do a lot of outdoor stuff, and now I can do it. Body's getting a little ragged for it, but I can still do most of it. So, having a great time. It's been very busy, but, God, it's awfully nice. That alarm went off at, 3:55 AM, 3 days a week, and, 5:15, 2 days a week for my whole working career. And I cannot tell you how nice it is to wake up when the body wants to wake up instead of when the alarm goes off. It is such a joy.
Can work out when you want to work out. You can do everything when you want it. It's a little bit different. It's just, I don't know, even just working from home, it's just, I have a little bit more freedom. I can sit there and say, I'm going to go downtown and get the mail now, because we have our offices downtown in the UPS store. It's like, I'll go down, you know, whatever. Yeah. John, this has been an absolute pleasure. I absolutely enjoyed the time together. It was like, I learned a lot. And the book, everyone, Complete Joy. You really want to read this. It's a story about a publisher. It's a story about this, but it's also a story that really has wonderful stories written within it. So thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me. Yeah. Love being here. It's great to see you again.
I know. It's great to see you too. It's great to see you finally. Okay. To everybody else, we'll see you next time. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from Turning Pages, The Adventures and Misadventures of a Publisher, narrated by the author, John Sargent, courtesy of Skyhorse Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. The show has been produced by Jordan Red Productions. And now, hear an audiobook excerpt from Turning Pages, The Adventures and Misadventures of a Publisher, narrated by the author, John Sargent. Copyright 2023. Courtesy of Skyhorse Audio.
Prologue. I am a low-hanging branch on two notable family trees. On my dad's side, there was a famous early feminist, an important conservationist who helped save America's forests, an artist of stellar reputation, and a doctor who took a bullet in the J.P. Morgan assassination attempt. Mom's side was less varied. There was a general who fired the first shot in the Civil War, and a whole bunch of book people. The book people go back three generations and include, among others, five authors, three chief executives of publishing companies, one independent bookstore owner, and an editor-in-chief. Throw in my generation, add the book people on the Sargent side, and you get another two chief executives, two more authors, two more independent bookstore owners, another editor-in-chief, and a guy who ran book clubs. The family counted for a lot of ink. My mother's grandfather, Frank Nelson Doubleday, was born in 1862 and grew up in Brooklyn, 16 blocks and a world away from where I live today. He started his first business at age 11, printing advertising flyers on a hand-cranked single-sheet press in his basement. At age 14, when his father's hat business failed, he quit school and went to work for Charles Scribner, a prominent publisher of the time. Frank did well, and in his late 20s, he came up with an interesting idea. Frank took a train to Vermont to pitch his idea to a popular author of the day. The plan was to publish the author's previous books in a handsome series, never mind that the books were owned by other publishers. The notable author liked young Doubleday's plan, and Frank set to work. It was a daunting task, but he finally convinced the publishers to cooperate, and the series was a huge success. The author, Rudyard Kipling, would become a central figure in Frank's life, and years later would give him the nickname Effendi, which is Turkish for chief, and a play on his initials, FND. Frank would no longer be called Frank. He was Effendi from that point forward.